Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hello everyone.
Gail, how has your writing week been?
Fiona, it's been bitty. Mm-hmm. I've had funny little odd things to do. I'm at the very early stages of a group project and it was my turn to write a bit in that. So I wrote that, so that at least made me feel productive. And I'm doing something I haven't done for ages. I've given up, you know, that wonderful morning routine that I completely mm-hmm. committed myself to, mm-hmm. given up on that. and I'm writing in the afternoons again, okay. which is something I haven't done for a very, very, very long time. So it's interesting and I'm just doing the best I can. I'm writing, if I touch the work in a day, I'm seeing that as good. So it's almost like I'm trying to get back into a regular routine and struggling. It's bitty is the best word I can apply. Do you have better news on this front?
Well, not exactly, because this last week I found myself doing something I haven't done in years, which was to cut a substantial number of words that I had written off a manuscript, gone forever. So I had produced maybe... Over the course of a month, I'd produced about 6,000 words,
yeah.
and I hacked off 2,000 and ended up with 4,000 usable words. And I don't regret it, but I'm just wondering why I wrote those words in the first place. What was I trying to avoid, or, you know, what did I think I was doing with those words that really were not helping anything? And that had to go.
You know, I know it is a part of a lot of writers' process that they do write too many words and hack them off. I am too lazy to do that. Mm-hmm. My superpower is my laziness and I don't write words that I have to throw away because it would kill me. But I know it is, it's a recognized process. So maybe you're experimenting with a new process.
I think I like that spin on it. But, you know, I used to do that as a younger and much more inexperienced writer. I would consciously overwrite knowing that I was going to cut maybe 20,000 words and get it from 100,000 down to 80,000. And I wrote with that intention. Mm. And yes, I think then my natural laziness kicked in and I thought, no, no, this is a big fat waste of time.
Mm.
And now I write much more intentionally with the idea that these are not going to be cut. These
yes.
words are going to stay. They're here to stay. And so having to cut those 2,000 words was a bit traumatic. I don't know quite what was going on in my head, but I hope I don't have to do it again.
It's interesting how, you know, we've both written a lot and you would think we'd know what we're doing by now.
You'd think, yes.
So if you're writing your first book and you feel like you don't know what you're doing, first of all, don't panic. It's normal. But second of all, don't think that's going to change. You can be on your 20th book and not know what you're doing.
Oh, dear. Well, our guest today is someone who has written about a woman in very unusual circumstances. And I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say. Our guest today is Lynn Joffe. Lynn was born in London, but now lives in South Africa. Lynn is the author of The Gospel According to Wanda B. Lazarus, which she completed in fulfillment of her MA in creative writing, which was awarded with distinction. She's also the author of a book for children with Adam Howard, and that book is called The Tale of Stingray Charles. Lynn has been a judge of a major literary prize, and we are very pleased to have her in studio with us. Hi, Lynn, and welcome.
Hi. Honored to be here.
Lynn, tell us, how has your writing week been?
My writing week has improved, let's say. Okay, when I was writing for Wanda, I had a strict daily routine that I wrote before I did anything else. I went back to my nook, which is my room of my own, which is only a writing room. It's like a sacred space I only found in 2016 when I was writing for the MA. I can write anywhere, but my commitment, my sacredness, my nun in the writing is in the nook. And in February, after 2 years of grieving, I went to the nook and I began to write for 2 hours a day. That's about kind of one Conrad, they call it, 800 words. That's all Conrad did. It's good enough for him, good enough for me. And started to gather again to re-establish the fragments before Wonder, which were other projects that were put down because of Wonder and then after my sister passed away, which when I couldn't write at all, so I thought. So my writing week has been very, it's almost like losing a part of yourself, losing a part of your mind, your soul, your brain. There were tiny little specks coming out of the scorched earth of the suffering that I've been through my sister. And so I've come back. I don't even know if I can write in anyone's voice but Wanda's voice, which is quite spooky. Mm-hmm. But I've got a, how do you call it, differing points of view in a thematic that I developed quite a long time ago. And I've got different characters' points of view about this event, including the nine-year-old me, who's now Lindy Lou on paper, who went through an experience of basically a comedian who suicided in our home in Australia when I was nine.
Wow.
The voice of the dead comedian, where I found the opening line. Can I say it?
If you...
Nobody was more surprised than I was when I woke up dead. And I thought, and I looked at it and I thought, oh, who wrote this? Oh, I wrote this. and so I'm being kind of lured back into the creative space, but it has to be disciplined. It has to be first thing. And if I'm sidelined by anything, cat food, a cup of coffee, it's the most impossible thing to go into. So, and also I must just say, Fiona, I remember you telling me long ago, and I've seen it, that you write different genres at the same time. And when you told me that, I was like, how do you do that? I concentrated on this Wonder book for so long that now that I'm kind of post-wonder and a little bit post-mourning, I've got three projects on the go. and it's like, I'm terrified and think, but Fiona's done it. And in a way, there's a kind of relief in being able to move to two different projects.
Mm-hmm.
So my writing week has begun to flourish again. And it's a very private and secret thing. So I don't know why I'm telling you.
It was very private and secret until this minute. And now everybody knows about it. Can I ask, sorry, I can get bogged down in process, but I have to ask, tell us a little bit about the Nook. I want to know what the Nook looks like. What do you have in the Nook that inspires you to write?
So interesting you ask. So we live in the smallest house on the highest hill in the lowest valley of Observatory. So we kind of in tree level. We live in the treetops. And there's a view of this treetop space to the south-facing garden that is actually a little sort of like a Lego block out of the house. And we used to have it as rocking chairs, and we thought we would eat breakfast there, and it never worked out. And in 2016, when my mother-in-law came to visit, and I was at the end of my second year of my MA, and I was in a crisis. I didn't want or need mother-in-law there. Or anyone else or anything else. And it's when I began to write Wonder again after 2 years of MA. I started again. Any of you want to write, to start again with your notes. And so I have what I call an owl desk. I bought it from Kensington, one of those old desks. And I'd had a dream of an owl at a desk I just had. So my owl desk is there. And then behind me, there's now shelves of what was the PhD, a lot of short stories, and a computer with double screen, because that's how I have to write from a double screen, from like the archives into the present. I number everything AA, BB, CC, DD in my dates. When I get to ZZ, I start with AAA. So in other words, I have to have the writing equipment in front of me. And there are two windows which are barred because it's Joburg, but I can see past the jacuzzi, which is empty because of Eskom, onto this beautiful green with where my kittens are now curious to come. And you can literally not swing a cat. You can swing, a business chair. What do you call those? An ergonomic chair in a circle. And that's all who can reach and get in there. And there's a Chinese wooden screen. You know those like flappy screens that you undress in Western movies to block me off from the rest of the room, because it's actually part of our lounge. That's
okay. So let's go back to your former project, Wonder Be Lazarus. Can you tell us, for the listeners, the myth of the wandering Jew and why that has come to be regarded as an anti-Semitic trope these days?
Okay, well, I'll have to presage it by saying that anti-Semitism is a very light sleeper, not my words.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-Semitism has always existed. for whatever reason, the otherness of the people who existed for 6,000 years was, and I put inverted commas, us. I happen to be of ethnically Lithuanian, Eastern European origin. And Gail and I have discussed this about how do you unbe Jewish? So I had actually, so in other words, from my culture, in my culture, I would like to explore the idea that anti-Semitism was given a metaphor in the wandering Jew who was historically, but this is mythically historically, at the cross when, or in fact, during the Via Dolorosa, Jesus's journey, who said, I thirst, and asked for some water from a soldier called Cartaphilius or a shoemaker called Cartaphilius who refused him his drink. He was thirsting. Not just for water, but it was literal and figurative. The shoemaker or the soldier refused Jesus this drink. In my book, I obviously take the piss out of that. But because of that, it is alleged that Jesus cursed this man to wander forever while he would return. Okay, which is also very philosophical and very spiritual. This seems to be the proof or the evidence that's been re-engineered into the Bible that the apart from having killed Jesus myself, which I was accused of at seven, is also is also the Jewish people's involvement in the crucifixion of Jesus, which I have very deep feelings about, but I wanted to explore it in the most lighthearted way. So then I found that Roger of Wendover, a.k.a. Bendover, was a monk in St. Albans in the Middle Ages, who wrote the myth of the wandering Jew or the fact of the wandering Jew into his Historia Flirorium type thing. And there was Matthew, there were a whole lot of them who kind of rabbi has been rear engineered into the Bible to remove the women, to remove the Shekinah, to remove the feminine. And so kind of with that feminist take on the wandering Jew, who was a hook-nosed, smelly wanderer, who had no shadow, who was given kind of tithings of the crop, and what was seen all over Europe, and particularly in the Middle Ages, was spotted. And then you get the whole thing of the wells that we poisoned, the babies that we ate for matzah, the money that we apparently own. So in other words, anti-Semitism and almost philo-Semitism too. And I wanted to explore it. So I found that the wandering Jew, and there's beautiful, drawings by Doré and of bearded, smelly, hook-nosed men. I thought, well, what if the wandering Jew was a woman? And not just any woman. A foul-mouthed, sexually charged Picara who wanders through the ages at the behest of the Muses of Antiquity in her quest to become the 10th Muse. So that might sound like a smash-up, but it was like taking the Greek mythology of the Hercules from a female's point of view or feminine point of view, and the wandering Jew myth, which you know, if you don't, you'll find out. Because everywhere Wanda went, that accusation, and then of course add to it that she's a woman, add to it that she has sovereignty over herself to a degree, because I think sex and women, I love the sex scenes. She wrote the sex scenes. I didn't even write them. Because that is a woman's sex. So it was very much getting into the, prejudice against my kind, if you like. But then if you read it as a piece of feminism, it's happened to us forever and ever. So the wandering Jew is a myth actually created by monks in the Middle Ages and re-engineered back to the Bible to prove that the Jews killed Jesus and we were not worth living and, well, in fact, we were not worth dying, because being immortal is also a very interesting concept. And I wanted to explore the idea that my character was immortal because she was accidentally cursed by Rav Yossi, who's my Jesus, at a time where he needed a drink, but the chalice was poisoned and she couldn't give him the drink. So there's an absolute, everything is ironic in a way. But the idea of it, especially now that anti-Semitism has kind of raised its head again, I think that the book has kind of more resonance now than it maybe did 4 years ago.
I'm very interested in the way ideas arrive, and I'm just listening to you to talk about, it's such a multi-layered idea and got so many different pieces, and then in the book becomes, you know, so different times. But did it arrive in little pieces, or did it arrive like an egg?
I wish.
Did you go, oh, here's a great idea, or did it come together slowly pulling those pieces together?
Thank you for the question. That is so interesting. I first had the concept in a way about the wandering Jew as a woman. That was the big idea, if you want to call it that. That was the major idea. Then I found out, before there was any character in my brain, I was going to do memoir. No, darling. I was going to write about all about my apartheid childhood, which is interesting to a degree. But the fiction took over when I found the face of the woman who's, or the man, or the it, or the them who's on the cover, which was the face. She became a character. I'm sure you both know what this feels like. Started in memoir. I found something that was like a, if you want, it wasn't an egg, it was a fragment of an egg, and went, actually, what about if it's she, if it's a me who's she, not Lynn? And in fact, my MA, reflective essay was written by Wanda, because you've got to put a proposal and you've got to write the work, then you've got to say what you've written. And Wanda wrote it. It was rejected for being too creative. And I had to, wasn't quite academic enough. But in a way, the magic of it, or the mystery of it, is when you get engaged in a character who takes the writer to places the writer's never been. I couldn't have written this book had I not had the life experiences. No, I have never been drowned in the Neva as an avatar of Rasputin, but I can tell you that sleeping in a car in Canada in the early 80s with my husband round the tire in the back was kind of similar. So I think that the egg, I think it's a flow rather than an egg. I think it's a thread. Life experience to me really matters. I don't know how people are able to write as youngsters, except from their own youngsterness. I can write it from any age that I am now. I don't know what it's like to be 90 yet, but I can write as a 9-year-old. In fact, Wanda's voice, the first thing, this was the first Easter egg. I wrote voice for a year. That's all I did, was what she was thinking. And it became so navel gazing that in year two, and of course in the lectures, in the tutorials, everybody asked you questions, and we had Ivan Vlad and Philippa Yar and Michelle. We had the most amazing readers, which was actually, that was the fun fair where the Easter egg went. And there were people saying to you, like Vlad said to me, I do suggest that if you're going to do something like this, you must keep it a bit linear, because no one's going to know what's going on. I had one day become a dog. I heard her become a 400-year-old woman. She's archetypal, but she's archetypal with a human touch. And I think that because I was doing an MA, because I had to stroke my beard, I had to think about, it's almost like bifurcation of the brain, because there's the creative brain doing the work, and then there's the scientific kind of mistress of arts, hearing what people are saying. I used to type everything that everyone said. I drove them nuts. I can touch type as fast as they speak. So I absorbed it, like I inhaled this MA. I wish I could find that again, because it was an obligation which is driven from me intrinsically, but it's nice to have a deadline.
Yes, I wanted to ask about that. This process of being supervised, of being guided through your manuscript, and also having these implied deadlines, which are perhaps a bit flexible. Was it helpful? Did that supervision guide you in a positive direction? And would you want to go through that process again?
I'm married to an ex-academic who's very clever. And I didn't tell him that I'd applied for this MA. And when I got in, I was ecstatic that I would have a kind of guardrails, if you like. Mm. And he said to me, what are you expecting from this MA? And I said, a literary therapist, because I go to therapy, a literary Elizabeth. And, you know, guide my hand, take my hand, hold my hand when I'm down. He said to me, you're very likely to get overworked, underpaid, indifferent lecturers who give a shit whether you live or die. It wasn't quite as bad as that, but it was pretty much that. You get assigned a supervisor, which I had thought would be, you know, the love of my life and my guide and my heart. It's you're alone in a dark room writing. And if you've got a deadline in 2 weeks' time and you know that you've got to read everybody's work, research your own and write your own every 2 weeks, it kind of sharpens your pencil. So I think it was more about the discipline and structure than it was about the creative approbation, recognition, criticism even. But it was very good to have high minds see the work, and the enthusiasm and passion. The late Mark Burr came in the end of our first year, and he set the place on fire. He didn't. He used to talk about the writer in the third person. So, woohoo, me. And his thing, he said to me, this is stellar and la la la, but where's the backstory? I want 200 pages. He didn't say do it. I want to know where this character came from, what her grandmother ate for breakfast. Salman Rushdie, in his Midnight's Children, I think it is, writes 200 pages before you even get to the present moment. So there were ideas put to me. They were put it to me, like in a legal counsel, put it to me that this is a Picarar novel, which I didn't know, which apparently it is. When I finished the MA, I couldn't put a picaresque out as a novel because there's no transformation. So things that I didn't know on an academic level, which would affect my creative flow, that was vital for me then. As I've told you both, at the end of 2020, when Wanda was published, the same academic husband said to me, so where's your next book, Lynn? And I said, can I have a Christmas day off? And I had wanted to think about it. I like the idea of Prof Joff. I like the guardrails as well. And I pitched to the University of Pretoria and was accepted on the basis of the work for Wanda. Spent the whole of 2021 marketing Wanda and writing a few short stories because that's what I was going to do. And then my sister got sick and I couldn't work for 2 years. I'm not doing my PhD anymore because I have an international agent now and she's expecting a manuscript at the end of June. And I think that just in terms of my age, and not because of my age, but because I'm a very mature writer and I've only got about another 30 years to live, what is it that I really want to be doing? And that is writing. So the answer to, I think that the MAs, PhDs are great, but if you're not writing, there's no PhD on earth that's going to get you a book written, finished, recognized, published, awarded.
Lynn, I think that's actually quite profound advice, because I think a lot of people, and I'm often tempted into this thinking myself, use that energy that they should be using to write a book, to do an academic thing, to do another degree, to add some more letters to their name. And actually, you need, listeners, to sit down and write your book.
If I had one meme of advice for anyone, and I do this all the time because it's so profound and I'm sure you know it, and it's from Uncle Ernest Hemingway, who says there's nothing at all to writing. Just sit down at the typewriter and bleed. But if you're doing your magnum opus that is going to change the world and you've been sent it to 60 publishers and they've all said no, maybe you should be writing another book. Can we talk about procrastination? Because I think that that's a huge issue for a lot of people, but it's a wrong word. Is it fear? Is it fear of self?
I have found a whole new version of procrastination, which is writing procrastination, where I'm writing the actual book and the words I'm spewing are just words on the page because I'm scared to get into the meat of it. Mm. Because I know this is the acid test. This is where my novel is going to stand or fall on this. And so I just write around it and I babble and I, you know, just add words to the page and 300 words done. That's me done for the day. And then I go back and I cut all of it. And I realize that I was procrastinating on the page.
That's
and
interesting.
I don't know if either of you had that.
Do you ever talk to yourself and say, this is procrastination? When you go back to read it, how do you know that the words are not valid? How do you know that?
It's so incredibly clear. I just delete the whole lot. I will sort of select and delete. I just in this last week deleted 2,000 words.
Oh my God.
Forever.
Ouch.
Gone.
Not
gone.
A detritus file even.
Not saved in the Kill My Darlings file. Gone. And they needed to go.
But I wonder if that, again, no effect on young writers, because you've got to do it whatever age you are, is being able to discern. Kawabata, who won the Nobel Prize in 1934, Chinese, I've read him in the English. He actually spoke, he writes fragments that he not found from his past in a shoebox, but the writings that we've got, I'm not talking about maybe novels, maybe just it's flash fiction of 100 years ago, and finding a piece that sings or zings. If it didn't fit into that book you were writing, would you be able to take it somewhere else for a walk to a short story or another piece? It's magic, eh?
Yeah, I would never procrastinate on the page because I am far too lazy to write 2,000 words that I'm going to throw away. My laziness is my superpower. It would protect me from that. Lynn, I want to stop us a bit before we get too deep and too into a very writerly conversation, because we haven't covered what we often cover, which is your superhero origin story. And you actually have a vibrant and well-established and well-known career in advertising. And I want you to talk a little bit just about, not so much maybe the advertising, because then I might get distracted into my day job as well, and we really don't want that. But the move from advertising to writing fiction and the relationship between the two.
Fantastic question. So a lot of people don't know what copywriting is. They think you in some sort of legal office. When I was a newlywed 20-year-old and I'd done a secretarial course, and I had no idea what I wanted to do other than be Laurence Olivier's little sister or a queen. I mean, I was very immature and I got married very young, and I was forced to do a secretarial course just like my mother, which, by the way, has served me very well over the years. And I went to, I was temping, as they called it, and everyone was in town, and I went and I did dictaphone. And as I was dictaphoning, this word copy kept coming up. And I remember, left hand, right hand. What is this copy of which they speak? All I've ever been good at is English speaking, writing. It's like kind of like, where did my journey begin? It began as a junior copywriter. I found out what it was. I drew my own stick figures. I left my secretarial temp and I found myself a job as a copywriter. And if any of you out there have ever been one, everyone should train as a copywriter. You are given briefs, you rewrite them 30 times, you find the strategy, the objectives, the USP, all of that. When I was so I did that, and I call this the bleeding, breeding years between 15 and 50 as a woman. From the time you get your period till the time menopause, ladies, just serve. Serve with grace. And it's almost in a way between those years that I worked and have worked. And when I went through perimenopause, which nobody talks about ever, it's not on any form.
Oh, no, it's become a big thing to talk about, and I'm pleased to announce I talk about it all the time.
Excellent. So I still ran the business, and then I went through kind of menopause, and I went through a kind of a Ruth period where the children's books started pouring out of me, pouring. The moment I couldn't conceive any longer, all these little books started getting born. But so from the copywriting discipline, I've often joked and called this book 100,000 headlines, because every word you write and every word, every and, every dot, every is scrutinized, approved by people who don't have the same writing skills. So I'm kind of inured to criticism. But the discipline of maybe the 30 years in advertising let me have the Sitzfleisch to express something that was important to me and not briefed by anyone else other than myself. And I find that, you know, you can say the segue. I don't know if anybody earns money out of literary fiction in this country. Hats off. And I was mistaken when I was told that millions of people would read my book. Millions of people haven't read my book because it's South Africa and it's a small bubble. And now that I have an agent, the book has aged like fine wine. But it's time to, and in fact, what's also interesting is now that I've had my say, you know, can I die a happy woman? Because in a way, the energy that went into this book and nine muses who I then had, and I had Alison Lowry as my editor, who is my spirit animal, who found the potential in the book worthy, that was another 2 years. And so that was in a way, and I didn't know what an editor did as opposed to a creative director never says, put the word and in there. He just goes, write it again. So in a way, my discipline and my structure, yes, is talent, schmalent. Everybody's got a talent. It's the, my sister had a talent, but she didn't have the discipline to put it into a construct. So the segue was, my business was going well. I had made my staff were not, I had made my staff were now my, the directors of the company in BEE space. It was beautiful. It was running, and I could take a little step backwards and do the discipline. I changed my office working hours so that I could work from 6 to 9 and still be at the office. I didn't always have to be at the office. We have a production company, so a lot of multicultural work got done. But it was like I kind of rewarded myself, if you like, with the indulgence of, not indulgence, but the necessity indulgence of writing the book that, there's nothing as painful as an unwritten novel deep inside you or something like that. And so by actualizing that, I feel like I reached a peak. I think I've wasted, in inverted commas, my PhD time, but it hasn't been because, if you want to go there, the grief that overtook me in the diagnosis and death of my sister took death to a whole different level.
Yes, I want to ask about that. What grief can do to the creative spirit, and whether there ever comes a time that one can access that grief and transform it into something creative.
Rilke, what you've just said. So for those of you who don't know, my younger and only sister, full sister, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer at the beginning of 2022 and passed away that end of that year. And I've now had a year of the post-death mourning, which killed me too. So I've kind of spent 2 years in a pre-anticipatory grief state and then a grief state. I had said to myself, I haven't written, I haven't read, I haven't done business. I reduced my office. I rented out the mansion and I went to Cyprus, which is where she passed 4 times. I went a 5th time at the end of last year, and I've kind of acted out the state I've been in, which also means if I couldn't get out of bed for 3 weeks, I just didn't. During that time from her, and trying to put into the writerly space, I felt that I hadn't written anything. I was just in writing meds down and closing down the aspects of her life, and then we had to tidy up her life. If I look at it now, which is kind of like, I don't even know, 2 years later, a year later, it's later. I look back on that time, kind of, I want to say, forgive me, Lane, with a writerly eye. So all of what happened when she died, which was December 22, is that I started writing to her. Mm-hmm. I couldn't process this loss without connecting with her. And so I've written to her about her and to all the adjectives to her about her with her, because I took back some of her diaries, which were a lot deeper than we ever thought that she was. She was kind of the abandoned daughter. There's a myth which predates Christianity and Judaism and everything from Mesopotamia, which speaks about the sun goddess Inanna and her dark sister. And the sun goddess gets a call to go to the dark sister, and she has to go through a whole lot of gates and divest herself of all of it. It's almost a kind of reverse Hercules myth. And while I was on the journey with my sister, it occurred to me that I was kind of tapping into this myth of the dark sister, light sister, which we always have been. She was a lot darker than me. She was a Sephardic throwback. My father passed out when she was born. I was the Gerber baby. You start seeing your life in a kind of in a mythical way. And then she died. It was a lovely story, except she died. And I lived, but I thought I'd died. So, and I don't know if other writers experience this, but it was like, at some point, this will come into words. But for the 2 years that it wasn't in words, and I journaled. That's when I talk about the 2,000 words that you cut out, really looking back at, and then I took myself, when she was cremated, she wanted to be brought back to South Africa. We got the ashes in a state. They didn't all fit in. I went to the beach. I let her ashes go and I wrote. I went to a retreat on my own, and I must have written 17,000-20,000 words in those 2 days. I haven't had the courage to look at them again. But there might be something in, not might be something in there. It's almost as if to, when you talk about the closure or the meaning or the purpose of this death in my life right now. I wrote a book about a time traveling woman who dies at the end of each chapter. She's hung, she's stabbed, she's, you know, it was so flippant. If I look at it now, please read it still because it's really funny, but it gave death a whole new depth. And nothing will ever be the same again. I hope it's not to be funny. I want to bring people to the understanding of what I'm experiencing. And because my sister was so funny, right until the end, I mean, we had the horror and we had the lightness. And because I was in a state of grace that was also a state of shock, that was also a state of irritation. I don't know if there's a man with a beard in the sky who's got my sister in his arms. I can't do that. But the fact that you're living with death in life. Aphrodite is the goddess of love and death. My sister died in Cyprus, Aphrodite's island. There's another myth for you. So if you're asking me how it's changed, I imagine it has changed. But I don't know about it until I've reinfragmented what I'm really trying to say, which is not an advertising.
I've always thought that I didn't write between my first book and my second book because I didn't have a good idea and because I was having babies. And I've just realized it was grief. My parents died around when my first baby was born, my parents died. And I've always thought the babies were the problem, that I was busy with the babies. But actually, I think it was grief. So you've given me an enormous insight.
Of all of the cliches I've been given about death, and Kubler-Ross, and I've read a lot, and my psychotherapist, the one writer who has helped me, literally helped me, is Rainer Maria Rilke. And there's a collection of his condolence letters, I'll find the name, where he writes to people who have lost a dog, a mother, a father, and he speaks about the necessity to bring that death back, not the death back to life, but to live in a sense of purpose within that death. Not in spite of, but because of. And if I would do the memoir to my sister now, I'd probably put a Rilke sort of headline on each one, because there's something so deep. He says the same thing over and over again, but it's written. You've got to unpack it and unpick it. And that's what, I mean, when I see these lovers only chatter, friends, all that matter, I can't with the poetry. But when something resonates with me, I am changed and I don't know how.
Lynn, I want to talk to you about this idea of memoir. Because you've kind of implied that you wouldn't write a memoir, but having followed you on social media, where you give us little tantalizing glimpses of a very interesting childhood and perhaps a lot of childhood trauma, but you only give us little glimpses, I would be very intrigued to read your memoir. Is it not a place you would consider going?
On your desk, 8 a.m. Monday morning. So I'm very interested in the, how would you call it, the crossover or the seg of what actually really happened and where my imagination can take it. So maybe I had to be more mature to do that, but I saw your comment and I thought, give me a brief. But there's also now because my sister has died and there's a memoir in the offing, I don't know that could be fictionalized. And then I think of what Anne Lamott says, which is, if you're going to write about people, give them very small genitalia, which did work with Wanda. I wrote a book which is based on the Picaro, who is a careless, devil-may-care character who wanders through events, never learning, never growing, never transcending. Very much based on the character of my sister Lane, which is very much who I am, but maybe with a little bit of extra self-esteem, perhaps. If I then go into the character mindset of my sister, which is devil may care, there's a lot of things that went on in her life. There's a Jewish phrase, kol isha erva, the voice of the woman is inappropriate, which is actually also re-engineered back to the Torah and Song of Solomon. So I am segueing, but in a way, everything I write is about the voice of the woman is inappropriate. I've discovered my mother's songs about I stand at the crossroads from her teenagehood and my mother's mother's teenagehood and my mother's 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 teenagehood, and I've been told don't write an epic about South Africa. So if I was 30 and I had 16 books to write, they may come out.
I want to pivot for a moment because there's something I want to ask you that I really think you can add value to our listeners with. Now, on the back of The Gospel According to Wanda B. Lazarus is a shot from Stephen Fry, and I asked your publisher, how did this happen? And she told me, Lynn asked him, and he did it.
That's exactly right.
So I want to talk about how it's not enough just to have written a book. You have to promote it, especially in the modern space today when publicity budgets have been slashed and you can bring out a book and it can die a quiet death, and then you bring out the next one, it also dies a quiet death, and you have not allowed your book to die any kind of a death. You have kept it green and in everyone's minds. So can you talk to us about that process?
I have one word for you all. Chutzpah. Chutzpah isn't just cheekiness. It's not just forwardness. Remember that I'm a copywriter, okay? And I've also was told, and I'm also only three, because I've only been published for 3 years. So I'm an actual three-year-old in the body of
not
an old, wrinkly, white chick. There is nothing wrong with asking. They call it usually, when you finished a book, whether it's your agent, you know, having your nails done, I've got friends who said, you know, someone must do it for me. You can do it for yourself. What I had was I had a website prepared. I sent him my examiner reports, which were very glowing. I knew that he was on the level, if you like. It was kind of within that kind of South African Monty Python transgressive humor that he would like. So he was my ideal reader, actually, if I think about it. But what I had ready for him was the backup of that. So I didn't send him, so I'd sent him a chapter of the novel, which was on the little website. And then I found a way of getting him the book. Not everybody will do this. And Stephen is very generous. In fact, he's been accused of being on the blurb of everyone now. But I wrote that pitch email that I wrote, took me about 5 days, and I'm a fast copywriter because I didn't want a fangirl. I didn't want to schmooze him. I didn't want to pick him up. And then I wrote to one of my publisher, editor people. I said, oh, my God, I've got Stephen Fry's number. And she said, well, if he doesn't give you a shout, just put it down to his laconic British personality. And I went, oh, I didn't even think of that. So I said, if you like what you've seen, a lovely little quote would be lovely. And within 10 hours, I had a response. Amazing. And I have used that with great grace. So, you know, you begin to find out what's real and what isn't. An agent is called death by optimism. I'm okay with that because how did I find my agent? I went on an online conference. We got put into breakout rooms. I had my spiel ready. If I speak to any author of any stripe, it's like when you said to me, tell me about the Wandering Jew. I have memorized that and I can break it apart to anyone in a lift. Oh, and it's funny. It's a tragicomic tale, and not everybody likes it. Not a lot of Jewish people like it. Not a lot of religious right, although some of the religious right have said it's very nice to have a left winger come with such a sense of humor. I was like, eh, lovely, lovely. I'm unafraid. It's made me unafraid. But then not everybody's got Stephen Fry's email address. So there was the chutzpah. He could have never responded.
Did you know that Stephen Fry was Jewish when you did this? Because, you know, he's one of those quiet Jews.
Stephen Fry is of ethnic Jewish origin. His mother is Jewish. His mother came out of the Holocaust. The children didn't know until they were very grown up, and it's all documented that she had come out. Had I chosen anyone, I'd like a gay, closet, Jewish, British comedian with a sense of transgressive humor. And he is my fairy godfather.
Love it. Well, Lynn, we like to ask all our guests what they have been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on them.
So the CCI Awards, which have just been awarded, Creative Industry Awards, I had to read many, many, many dozens of books to evaluate fiction, nonfiction, children's fiction, and publishers, which has just happened last weekend. So I had to take a deep and very icy dive into South African literature. I have to admit, I read a lot, and I like, you know, the foreign writers, and I like Japanese writers, and I like, so I've kind of had a space in my schedule to raise my understanding and experience. Not every publisher entered, so there were a lot of books that I still need to read. But the standard of South African fiction is very high. It's very diverse. And Vernon Head's book was the one that we chose to win. And they've now asked me for a blurb, so I'm going to have to write a proper review. But it reminded me of Faulkner. It was voices. Also, I like this multiple voice idea where the voice of a seagull is a character. Mm-hmm. It just switches on my creative imagination. And then there's a great surge of South African writing. And I hope that it continues more than maybe just Afrikaans romance drama. There's books I'm looking forward to reading that I haven't had time for. But what do I read in my secret special space? I'm reading Rilke again, and I'm reading Rilke again, and I'm underlining, and I've got pink, green, orange. It's almost like I want to absorb him. I want to inhale him. And I'm not a great poetry reader, but this prose is doing it for me.
Fantastic. Well, we hope that everybody buys The Gospel According to Wanda B. Lazarus, which I still see in bookstores everywhere, so it's still in print. And we are very much looking forward to the next thing you bring out, and it's not crystal clear whether it's going to be memoir or fiction or a mashup, but we're looking forward
to it. We're excited, and I was pleased to hear that there's a deadline in the mix, so you're going to be forced into doing it. So that is very exciting news.
And then there's the audiobook, which we've been working on for years, literally, which I'm voicing, which is also, I keep saying to Hola, is this funny, Hola? He says, it's funny, Lynn. Carry on. So that's in the offing, but then again, a good book is forever, like diamonds are forever. Thank you so much. Could talk for hours.
I have to just say, I wish that the listeners could also have watched Lynn through this.
Yes.
Because Lynn, your expressions have added so much to this experience and to the layers of your communication, and I've just enjoyed myself so much. So thank you very much.
It's like a kindred spiritness. The three witches of East Witz.
Thank you, Lynn. Gail, I think Lynn is an example to all of us on how to be an effective writer and an effective marketer of your own books.
I was fascinated. She has an energy about her that is extraordinary. And I found that such an interesting discussion and so many levels of discussion. I took quite a lot out of that.
Tell us in particular, what did you get from it?
So I took a lot of things, but I think the thing that resonated with me the most is her talking about that the difference between a person who has talent, and I think she was talking about her sister, and she said her sister was immensely talented, but didn't have that drive, that determination. Yes. I'm endlessly fascinated by that difference. What is it that a lot of people have a book in their head? What is the difference? Why have I been able to sit down and write a book? And I do think it does come down to that there is a certain determination that some people have and some people don't have. And I'm interested in that. And it's a thing you wish you could bottle and give to a person and say, here, just drink a little bit of this and then you'll get your book out too.
Well, the magic potion that Lynn has in spades that I do not have is the ability to promote my own work.
Mm.
And it has really taken her far, and she has built her writing career, you know, from ground zero into something very interesting. I mean, she's now a judge for this major literary award, and she made that all happen for herself. I wish I could bottle that and take that potion for myself, because I just feel such reticence. There are times when I have to do it. I can't avoid it. Like something new's come out, I've got to talk about it. But I just feel so reluctant to do it. In fact, I feel reluctant to engage on social media at all at the moment, even just personal stuff. And I'm struggling with it. I don't know how to get over it.
Do you think the difference is that you and I know we both are introverts at the end of the day, and it's hard when you're an introvert to put yourself out there in such a considered manner. It's hard to make yourself into a brand.
It is. It is hard. But why can we do this? Why can we host and run a weekly podcast and that doesn't sort of suck our introvert energy in the exact same way?
Very interesting. Maybe because we're actually just sitting here in a room speaking to each other.
And somehow I just feel more comfortable sort of platforming other authors in a way.
Maybe that's part of it as well, the inability to blow your own horn. And I think maybe a lot of us are brought up not to do that. And I think Lynn just has that, as she said, that chutzpah. That she's managed to work beyond that lesson that we all of us are given, and women are given very strongly, of don't blow your own horn, don't be the tall poppy, you know, all of those lessons. And even if they aren't given that to us deliberately, society gives it to us. It's very hard to stand up and go, I think I've done great work here, and I think everybody should read my great work.
Yeah.
And maybe Maybe we need to learn to do that, Fiona.
I think we do. I really do, because no one else is going to do it for us.
And I wrote a note here that she said, do it for yourself. No one else is going to do it.
Absolutely. So what have you been struggling with, or advice for readers, or what do you want to chat about
so
today?
I want to chat about beta readers, which mm-hmm. is the concept. Some people say beta. I think it's beta. It's the concept of having readers who read your book, the first draft of your book, as I understand it, because mm-hmm. I don't do it. So I only have a theoretical understanding of it. That you have a trusted group mm-hmm. who then you give the book to, and they give you initial feedback. I've done it with one book. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested to know whether you do it, and I'm interested to know if you find it useful or confusing.
I've done it formally once for one of my self-published Kindle books, where I had this tribe of readers who had responded very well to the first in the series and then responded badly to the second. And it was so derailing to me. I could see that their response was a very sort of personal glitch mm. with the material, and that therefore I wasn't to take too seriously what they were saying. But it also undermined my confidence so much that I never did it again. But I have just in my life, my older daughter, my husband, I've mentioned before that Georgina Geddes did a first read of The Hidden, which was extremely useful. So I've got certain trusted people, but not a whole tribe of readers that I'll send a book to.
And to what extent do you take the advice on board? So if Georgina says XYZ, do you then do XYZ, or do you filter it yourself?
I take it very seriously, because she reads so many books and is such a good judge of a book, and also was coming at me with no kind of personal agenda or personal problems with the material. It was just pure helpful tips. So that kind of thing I can very easily take on board. And if my daughter says to me, you've rushed the ending, which is my besetting sin, then I know I've rushed the ending. And even though I really don't feel like it, I've got to go back and flesh it out more. Is there a reason why you've stayed away from doing that?
The one time I did it, I found it confusing. Mm-hmm. The reason I've come back to the question is because I had a very interesting insight from one of my first readers of my upcoming novel, and it's still at a point where it's in time for me to make very small tweaks, but mm-hmm. that to some extent will address a discomfort she had with an aspect of the plot. And I thought it made me question, should I be doing this more? Should I be doing this more actively? Should I be seeking a trusted reader early in the process, or is what I'm doing working for me? So I was interested to hear what you had to say on that.
Do you do it for other people? Are you a trusted reader for other writers?
I have recently done it for somebody, but it's not something I've done a lot. And it's something I would be quite scared of doing, because it's hard. How honest do you have to be, you know? And what if the book is crap? Mm. And I really, really hate reading books, drafts by people I don't know.
Right.
That's the
right.
thing I actively avoid doing. Like I say to people, I will give you advice on how to write and the process of writing, but please don't make me read your unpublished manuscript. And it's because I think early in my career, I had a few experiences of reading utter rubbish and then not knowing how to say, this is terrible.
Yeah. I've done it. I've actually been asked quite a few times by published authors to look at their work in progress and give them feedback. But I always just try to be constructive. I just try to give praise where praise is due, and you can always find something helpful or something good about manuscript, but also constructive help of what could be done to make this manuscript better.
It's an interesting area, Fiona, and you know, we're both struggling with our writing at the moment. One wonders if maybe letting more people into that world of writing is a way to solve some of these problems. I don't know, jury's out on that. I'll get back to you.
Well, if any of our listeners have read Lynn Joffe's work, The Gospel According to Wanda B. Lazarus, if you've encountered her on social media, if you have thoughts about anything we've been talking about, please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.